So today's class is the exciting class because we get to a different kind of practicality, like a conceptual practicality. So it's like the point where you kind of marry the level of conceptualization from the first class and the level of practicality from the second class into kind of a single final product. Which is why the first class was mercury and the second class was sulfur and this is salt. So the whole progress has been alchemical, essentially. Kind of to start off in looking at the way in which these things dovetail together, we're kind of dealing with the whole science-technology relationship, in which science, in a pure sense, is means of seeking after knowledge and understanding of things just for the sake of that knowledge and understanding, which is largely what we're dealing with in terms of kind of the conceptual, theoretical, spiritual alchemy context. Technology then is the application of that knowledge in order to create something which makes our ability to work within the world more efficient or more enjoyable. And that's where we get into some of what goes on in practical alchemy with the creation of tinctures and medicines and ways to make initiatory processes easier. What kind of becomes a little bit interesting in looking at this also is looking at the relationship between religion and science and magic and technology. Religion essentially is to magic what science is to technology. If you look at religion and science around the dawn of chemistry as a science separate from physics, you start to see this movement towards atheism within science, that everything is just dead matter, and these ideas about God and spiritual realities are all unnecessary and unobservable and irrelevant, and it's just a way of people understanding the world before they had real science to use to understand the world. And religion, of course, takes the counterpoint that science is all empty and cold and doesn't recognize the true reality of things and doesn't fulfill the human spirit. And they basically just have a little pansy fight between each other over who should have dominance. Yes, but in reality, they're kind of the same thing. Religion is trying to understand the world in terms of the underlying quintessential reality of things, and science is trying to understand the world in terms of the observable physical reality of things. The two don't have to necessarily contradict each other, even if they seem to be saying things which are very different. You can look at ways in which the physical reality is a symbol for that underlying quintessential reality, which was a lot of what we talked about in the first class, of course, in looking at the development of the heliocentric and geocentric views of the universe and how either one can play out as a means of explaining spiritual phenomenon, regardless of their reality in a physical sense. But we can easily look at the actual physical reality and find ways that it matches out to mythology or matches out to spiritual ideas, much as Newton did with determining that the formula for the net was the combination of copper and Mars because it spoke to Greek mythology that he felt was a means of expressing alchemical realities. Magic then is the technology that stems from the knowledge that's gained through religious exploration. If religion is a means of understanding the way in which God works, the way in which the angels work, or the way in which the spiritual forces of the universe work that underlie the manifest reality that we experience, magic is the way of applying that knowledge in order to affect the manifest reality that we experience. So the magician, through his religion, whether he calls it that or not, seeks to know that a given force incites people to anger, whereas another force incites people to love, and that these forces relate in a given way, and that through that relation, he sees all sorts of other things manifest within the universe that relate to those same forces, and that by applying those things in a given way, he's able to apply that force in a given way and create the result that he needs. It's simply the manifest application of the spiritual view that he's been able to obtain through his observations. It's the same process that we see in science and technology. There's really no difference. Now, where we step closer to understanding how alchemy plays into this science and technology dialectic within religion is by looking at the Triangle of the Mysteries, which is a concept that you don't see talked about too much in contemporary systems anymore, but it's actually a very modern concept. It comes out of the Golden Dawn system and systems from that time. This idea that the mysteries are essentially three threads that weave together, or a triangle or pyramid, which has three points that hold the form together. And these points are essentially magic, divination, and initiation. Classically, they're referred to typically as evocation, astrology, and alchemy. But those are kind of symbols for the prime forms of each of these concepts, essentially the archetypes of these concepts. Now, you'll get people in the magical community who feel that magic should be all about just getting things that you want, or magic should be all about spiritual attainment. And so basically, you have people who only want to do magic and people who only want to do initiation. Divination rarely comes into the argument, and it's kind of seen by both sides as something that's useful, but the side that wants to just do magic, wants to use divination to figure out how they can get the things that they want, or what's going to be impacting them getting the things that they want. And the side that wants to do initiation wants to use divination as a means of exploring the spiritual realities of the universe so that they can further their initiatic journey. Both of these fail if they're on their own. If you get people who just want to go do magic, they'll be able to go do magic, but they'll always be trying to do magic for something else because they'll never be getting what it is they want. They can't fill the actual void, so they distract themselves, and a distraction eventually becomes boring, so they have to keep trying to distract themselves with different things. They never really get anything out of their magic that's going to be lasting or enduring. It's the same concept that we see in other religions, where they say that the reason that mankind experiences all sorts of turmoil and chases after all sorts of phantasmal things that aren't really going to help man is because man doesn't understand what he's actually seeking, and that it posits that man actually should be seeking after God in order to fulfill himself. The other failure in that approach is that magic is deepened by deepening your understanding. If it's the application of the understanding of the universe or the technology that goes along with spiritual science, then if you're not engaging in spiritual science, you basically are working out of how-to manuals. You're the guy that can go and put oil in his car but doesn't know the difference between an engine and a motor, or how those parts end up working together or individually working within the actual vehicle. So you're limited in what you can actually do with it. Now, on the other side of things, you have the people who just want initiation. They just want magic to be something where they can say, oh, I can increase my understanding of these spiritual forces, or I can go experience these other spiritual planes. And for some people, it is about actually moving on and bettering themselves and increasing their understanding or their closeness to the source. For some people, it's about having an escapism or experiencing some kind of spiritual high. And so for those people, it becomes the same as the people who are chasing after different magical manifestations to try to make themselves happy. They're looking for a distraction, but they're looking for more of an experiential distraction. So they're really no better than your common junkie in the street at that point. the failure people who are actually trying to chase after their own betterment and trying to come closer to the source is that part of that is understanding what your role is within the universe and what it is that you're supposed to be doing in order to function within the kind of clockwork of the universe. That's pretty much the crux of Thelema, is that you do all of this stuff in order to understand yourself and understand the world and the juxtaposition of the two. And in doing so, you're able to find how you can best fit into the world, and in fitting into the world appropriately, in a certain sense, you end up unifying yourself with that thing beyond yourself. But if your only skill set is developing understanding, and there's no skills towards the application of that understanding, then you get to this point where you're on the precipice and you don't know how to jump off of it without just crashing into the rocks below. So you gain all this understanding and have no means of using it. You don't know how to build a hang glider and fly across to the other edge. And so that's where the one hand that's doing magic and the other hand that's doing initiation have to come together. Divination becomes part of that bridge, in that it's a way of accessing those spiritual forces on an ongoing basis, and gaining knowledge of them and gaining knowledge towards specific practical applications. It develops the faculties that are needed in order to explore that knowledge in a detailed and uniform sense so that you can create technology from that knowledge. So you could kind of look at things as magic as the solfer, divination as the salt, and initiation as the mercury. But the way that it really plays out is that initiation is catalyzing and furthering your ability both as a magician and as a diviner. And magic is dealing with essentially changing the mercury or the state of things, and divination is experiencing or knowing that mercury or the state of things, and initiation is the process that allows you to hold those two within yourself and access and use them. So really, magic is kind of still the sulfur, divination is the mercury, and initiation is the salt. The worker or the magician is the alchemical laboratory, and so he's the body that corresponds to the initiation and contains these other processes. Another way that you can look at this is by kind of looking at the parts of the soul and how those correspond to the alchemical principles. In the Kabbalah, you have the neshama, or the higher soul of the self. You have the nefesh, or the spiritual matter from which the essential being of a person is created. The neshama and the nefesh join together in order to create the actual individual personage. The bridge between them is the ruach, or the intellect, which is the way in which the nefesh neshama is balanced, and that balance is communicated out into the world and understands the world in order to help create the way in which the two are balanced. And these three are all brought together and held within the guf, or the physical body. Now in alchemy, we see the guf in the salt. We see the neshama in the sulfur, and we see the nefesh in the mercury. But there's no real explanation of the ruach, because the ruach is the thing that kind of is operative and binds everything together and causes it to act and is kind of the crux point where everything meets. It's what causes the salt and the sulfur and the mercury to be able to interact together in a given and useful way. So the ruach is the operator, or the alchemist, sort of the combination of the laboratory and the alchemist as one unit. So in this case, again, we have the soul kind of corresponding to magic, the spirit corresponding to divination, and the body corresponding to initiation as the material that is initiated so that the operator, the intellect, is able to comprehend all of these things and direct their interaction. And the interaction that the operator is directing all of this towards is, of course, the great work. Now, the great work is kind of a term that frequently gets tossed around sort of meaninglessly. You'll see people say things like, "Oh, well, we've all come together and really work towards doing the great work today," when you're dealing with sort of social contexts of magical groups. And people aren't necessarily clear what they mean by that. Sometimes it's the great work of putting on the Gnostic Mass, or the great work of running a weekend of events, or the great work of maintaining the physical cleanliness and presentableness of the lodge. And it kind of becomes a common occultism, or, well, I guess you can't say occultism, magicism, related to the idea of you're getting together and working, and the work that you're doing is somehow related to the work that your spiritual organization does. But that's not really what the great work is. That can facilitate the great work. I'm not going to say that coming and sweeping the floors of the lodge can't be the great work, because it can be in a very Buddhist sense. In fact, in monasteries, frequently things like sweeping the floors are something that are done as a spiritual exercise. I used to find cutting the grass to be a good one for that. But it's not automatically just because you're doing some kind of work for your spiritual organization that's the great work. The classical meaning of the term refers to alchemy. Alchemy itself was the great work. And that's really where the term is coming from. Because it was the labor that was spiritual in nature and was built around correcting lesser physical modalities into greater physical modalities based on a spiritual influence. Now, this idea is part of why alchemy is the archetype for initiation, because it's classically, I mean, there were forms of initiation before there were things that we would necessarily categorize as alchemy. Initiations into priesthoods, initiations into mystery traditions, there were all sorts of initiations. Alchemy as being archetypical of initiation is based on the fact that it's a process where you initiate yourself by initiating things outside of yourself. And it's illustrating in a pure sense that the process of initiation isn't about joining a particular group or being recognized within that group as being on a particular level. Initiation is about making changes and transmutations in a thing in order to remove those things that are not the thing and those things which are incorrect, and reveal, galvanize, and multiply the things in it which are essential and which are true and which connect to that original divine primordial truth. Now, the concept of the great work and alchemy spreading out to initiation as a whole kind of connects to the Rosicrucian system and the development of the Rosicrucian movement, which originally was very alchemical in nature. If you look at the three principal Rosicrucian manifestos, one of them is entirely a book of alchemical symbolism, the chemical marriage. And it's describing processes of initiation and processes of the great work through alchemical symbolism. This idea of alchemy within the Rosicrucian movement also kind of comes down to the original purpose of the Rosicrucians. The Rosicrucians were originally seven in number, so they related to the planets. Each one could only have one apprentice because they were to contain themselves within that group of seven, so that there would always be seven of them, so that they always had the full planetary set. their job was specifically to heal. They learned all sorts of magical disciplines, but regardless of what type of magic they were doing it for the community, they were doing it for free, and they were doing it for the purpose of healing. And healing in a greater sense, not simply the idea of he has a wound, let me doctor his wound, but in a sense of the community is wounded or mankind is wounded because of the state of things. And so by engaging in these activities, which better ourselves, better our communities, better those that we're physically healing or that we're helping with other problems that they have, we are healing that wound that mankind has. Very much fits to the imagery of the Fisher King in the Arthurian romances, where the physical injury of the king is a symbol for the spiritual plight of the kingdom, and that by returning the spiritual source, the king is healed and the kingdom is healed. And this was essentially the nature of the early Rosicrucian movement, and part of why the movement became so popular. I mean, part of the movement becoming popular was because it was a secret Protestant organization working against the Catholics in order to have kind of a representation that Protestants could have mysticism too, and could have an organization that was a secret reformatory organization, much in the way that early Jesuits were kind of a secret counter to corruption in the church. But another part of it was also that it was this ultra-secret, elitist spiritual organization that no one could belong to because they would come and find you, and that would be how you would belong to them. So everyone wanted to belong to them, so it becomes rampant within early Masonry and all sorts of other spiritual disciplines there. But in doing so, it spreads this concept of the great work and initiation and ritual magic, and mysticism and spiritual seeking as a means of engaging in the great work. When you think of mystics like St. John of the Cross and St. Teresa of Avila, you don't think of the great work with them. You think about them gaining mystical visions of God. You think about the bed flaming in the passion of the divine when you think of St. Teresa, because that's the imagery that she's usually portrayed with. Because the whole idea is that they are experiencing a very individual spiritual enlightenment, a very individual sense of the divine, and they express it through their writing to help others. But that's not the point of their mysticism. The point of the mysticism is their own individual experience. When you look at the early Kabbalah, the idea was that the Kabbalist achieves the Edenic state and returns to Eden. Because it was, again, just the Kabbalist's individual spiritual experience that was going on. When you look at later Kabbalah, we start to see this idea that the Kabbalah is not about returning to Eden and is not about the individual, but it's about bringing about the Messianic age and allowing the Messiah to come, because it's about fixing the world. And eventually we start to see the Lurianic movement having systems of Kabbalah entirely based on this idea of reparation. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. But that's contemporaneous with the development and the spread of the Rosicrucian system and the Rosicrucian ideals. So this is where we start to get this idea that mysticism is the great work because it's functioning outside of yourself. It's not just a mysticism about initiating yourself so that you can have understanding and you can be part of this special group. It's initiating yourself so that you can be better, and be an icon and a force within the universe or within the society, in order to drive others onto initiation and development and work towards the greater good of solving the problems of society, or creating systems or balances which help offset those problems. And this is where, in the Rosicrucian movement, we get this whole lineup of science and religion and magic and politics. John Dee is sometimes credited as being the precursor to the Rosicrucian movement, or possibly even its original author or creator. And if you kind of think about these factors that go into defining Rosicrucianism, they're all things that are kind of where D is sort of the icon of these things all meeting together as a single cross point. So you have this combination of seeking after knowledge in a very physical sense, but doing so through seeking after knowledge of the divine, and then applying that knowledge so that you have greater magical and spiritual efficacy and capabilities so that you can help yourself and help the community. And that part of that is working within the political sphere to help guide the way in which the kingdom or in which the village or in which society is working and moving so that it fits the goals of the Rosicrucian order, which are to achieve the great work for everyone. And so this is where we get this mythology of the Great White Brotherhood. And it pretty much defines the function of the Great White Brotherhood, but also defines the nature of the great work, that it is a very globalizing process. It's not something that's just in the self or in the thing that you're doing immediately in front of you. It's a whole process of trying to change things beyond yourself by changing yourself and developing yourself. And now, on the surface, that all sounds very much like we're all going to be white knights and go out there and try and champion things and be heroes. But it's not that at all, because the universe doesn't only need that. There's all kinds of forces that need to be at play in the universe. And so, in understanding science and religion and magic, you understand that balance and understand where you fall into that. So any number of any types of behaviors could fall into the great work, but it's a matter of finding whatever your particular guiding principle is and enacting that within the world so that you are functioning within the world correctly as you are designed to, and therefore helping guide others to function correctly in the world as they're designed to. You become a counterbalance point in order to create balance in those things around you. Through creating a response to you, which is appropriate to the way in which your local portion of the universe is supposed to be running. And this is kind of what gets into the way in which the great work is alchemical, of course, in that alchemy is about going out and correcting yourself through correcting things outside of you, and the ability to correct those things outside of you comes from correcting yourself internally. That you're working the alchemical processes internally, and that's reflected in the things that you're doing outside of yourself. But your meditation upon and the fact that you are working the processes externally helps create those processes internally within yourself. It's a cycle of internalization and externalization of the process of initiation. As we mentioned a few minutes ago, the Kabbalah developed a similar system. Through the teachings of Isaac Luria, or the Ari. And it's called tikkunim, or reparations. The idea there was very, very Gnostic, in that when God originally created the world, he created the tree of life containing evil, or din. And because each sphere contained the spheres above it, every sphere after din contained this corruption or this evil, and so these spheres were not able to contain the divine light. So when the light hit din and then passed through the other spheres, it shattered them, and the light fell from the tree with the shards of the spheres and created the klipot beneath the world. God then repaired the tree with gevura, or severity in place of din, and then rebuilt the rest of the tree with spheres that were able to contain the light because the force was there in a corrected format. But it didn't correct what the result of the original tree was, and that was left to mankind to correct. So by finding these sparks of light within the darkness, the Kabbalist could engage in whatever was needed to balance out the darkness and raise the sparks of light back up to the tree. so that eventually all the sparks would be pulled out of the Klipot and pulled out of Malchut and rise up, allowing Malchut to rise back to the rest of the tree and not be weighed down by the darkness of the Klipot. So this was another form of this idea of initiation as a process of initiating the world around the mystic, so that the mystic could repair the rest of the world. This process is in and of itself kind of alchemical, when you begin to conceptualize the imagery as the Kabbalist or the alchemist taking this dross matter of the Klipot and kind of the demonic realms, and through his spiritual fortitude or through his right action, converting it into something greater than what it appears to be. He's essentially taking lead and making it into gold. In one of the classes this weekend, I mentioned the idea of the adept reaching down into the hells and finding the demons and bringing the demons back to their pre-fall state, creating and turning them back into angels through his interaction, basically functioning as Tiferet, entering down into the Klipot and allowing the light of Tiferet to bring the function of the kingdom back into the function of the legion back into the function of the divine kingdom. So that he essentially corrects the counterbalance to be part of the same balance. And this again is essentially a form of alchemy, or a form of initiating the darkness into something greater. This type of process, can be seen in the comparison between an initiated master or a master of the temple and a philosopher's stone. The philosopher's stone has the capability of being introduced to any inferior matter and turning it into the corresponding superior matter. It basically instantly corrects the vibration of a thing so that it no longer is subject to all of the dissonance, which is making it not function in the way in which it's supposed to, and allows it to function in its correct form. It's basically like instant initiation for whatever it's exposed to. Masters of the temple naturally exhibit the same quality, because they are functioning in an initiatic state where their basic nature is to understand and comprehend. And so that with which they interact, they understand in a bina sense. And so they absorb in some element of the nature of the thing, but the absorption and projection are equal because there's no opposition in the place in which they exist. So the process is one by which those who interact with the master of the temple are being corrected through that interaction. So the presence of the master of the temple functions like the presence of the philosopher's stone. They are able to reform the vibration of those with which they interact in an initiatic sense. This is a way of understanding the imagery that's described in One Star in Sight and in other portions of Crowley's writings regarding the nature of the Third Order and the nature of the secret chiefs, is that they guide the world towards greater initiation, but they do so invisibly, so that people are not necessarily aware of their influence. And so that's how it works in a very individual sense, that they kind of come into play and they're able to kind of move someone's vibration into a more correct phase, so that person's able to begin working more towards their own initiation and begin working more towards where it is that they're going. And the master of the temple is able to do this because he is essentially a point where the three principles are existing in a single state. The supernals on the tree of life roughly can be equated to the three principles, but the supernals don't act as individual spheres. The supernals are essentially all the same sphere functioning in a different fashion at a different time. Or being perceived from a different perspective. So the master of the temple contains within himself this balance of the principles. which is essentially the nature of the stone. So this is kind of where initiation reaches its crux point, which is also where alchemy reaches its crux point, is the creation of the stone. And essentially initiation is creating something that functions in a manner similar to the philosopher's stone within a given individual. Now, to be a little bit less lofty in terms of how we might apply alchemy to what we're doing as magicians, because saying, oh, well, when you become a master of the temple, you're basically a living philosopher's stone in terms of initiation, and so you'll be able to help correct people initiatically, and that's what your lantern is you're the guiding light from the point of being contained as a hermit, as a singular point of light that's expanded out everywhere.
Those magnificent beasts of men.
Yes. That, that's, I mean, yes, if everyone becomes a master of the temple, that's wonderful. But, it might not be for everybody. It may not be what's going to happen for everyone. And it's well down the path for most people. So, to look at where alchemy comes into play now, is a lot to do with how the language of alchemy and the ideas of alchemy work into your practical magic. I think I mentioned this in one of the earlier classes, I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure I mentioned it to Christian after one of the classes. That initially, when I got into studying alchemy, and before, actually before I got into studying alchemy, my view of it was that, much like James said on Saturday, that it was just fake science. That there was no real point in studying alchemy because we all knew that the things that were contained in alchemy were not real and they were just the underlying basis for chemistry and medicine. In fact, when we went through talking about alchemy in Western civilization class in high school, the class's perspective on it, or the way the teacher taught it, was much more sympathetic than my view of it, and this was in a Catholic school. But growing up and getting deeper and deeper involved with magic, I still really found no use for alchemy for the most part. And I kind of expected that I understood the basics of spiritual alchemy and what that entailed. Couldn't really describe it. I was just like, oh, it has to do with initiation and with balancing the elements through initiation, and then that reveals your soul, and that's what the Rose Cross is, and that's what alchemy is about. And to some degree, that's true. That's how the AA system works. And that's basically the alchemy of the AA system. And it has some to do with the alchemy that goes on in the Gnostic Mass. But there's a lot more to alchemy than that. And when I originally got interested in studying alchemy, it was because I was at a point where I needed to start studying more advanced magic. And a lot of the more advanced magic was written by continental magicians instead of British magicians. And the continental magicians were coming out of much more intense appendant Masonic lineages than the British magicians were. And a lot of those people were much more tied to the alchemical traditions of Europe because they were pretty entrenched in Germany and France and Eastern Europe. And a lot of the places that were covered under these empires that were there. So when I began reading more of this continental material, I would get to essays where it's like, I understand about 50% of what this person's saying because everything is being described based on alchemical processes. And I've heard some of these processes before, but I have no idea what they are. And so I was like, well, if I really want to read this stuff and understand it, I'm going to have to study alchemy. So I started off with just reading articles that I could find online about alchemy and getting a few books on alchemy. And I found that the ones that were like more with the contemporary modern New Age spiritual alchemy, like Dennis William Hauch's The Emerald Tablet, completely awful book. That it was just nonsense, and that I needed to study something a little bit more solid. So I started looking at older books on spiritual alchemy. And the thing that seemed consistent in those was that, one, they were describing magic and magical spirituality and initiation in a much deeper fashion, a much clearer fashion, and a fashion that seemed much more correct than what I was seeing in most other things that I've been reading up to that point. And two, they seem to be based on the idea that in order to really understand this, you had to have at least some understanding of physical alchemy. That the physical alchemy was not just a way of describing these things, and that it was all really about the spiritual processes, but that the interrelation between the physical and the spiritual was a large part of what was important, and that unless you were going to engage in at least studying laboratory processes, if not practicing laboratory processes, you were never really going to grasp what they were talking about. And so at that point, I started getting books on laboratory alchemy, this one actually being the first one, The Alchemist Handbook by Frederick Albertus. Because like I mentioned previously, that's pretty much the starting book for anyone that wants to have an idea about lab alchemy but may or may not want to actually do it. And reading that, I was like, wow, this actually makes a lot of sense. It's really clear. It's something you can really follow. The esoteric elements that he's describing seem reasonable. And he has a background in science, and it's science that's related to what he's actually doing here. And then the next book that I went to described things with even more depth than Frater Albertus did, and with more of a scientific basis. And the guy's science background was stronger than Frater Albertus' science background, and even more related to what he was doing. And so at that point, I was just hooked. And the kind of ironic thing was that I began just studying alchemy for its own sake and not to allow myself to read other books. And kind of spent enough time on alchemy that I didn't really get back to those other books. Like, I still ended up studying some of the continental occultism, but not really the things that I was initially having trouble with because I didn't understand the alchemical language. And eventually I need to go back to those. But studying alchemy can help you understand your magic and the magical processes that you're using, both in terms of initiation and in terms of practical magic. One of the most fundamental ones is recognizing the relationship between creation and destruction. I think we talked about that a little bit in the first class. In my lineage, one of the first things that neophytes are made to focus on is this idea that you have stability, and earth relates to stability. And that part of why you're starting off with an initiation related to earth is that's the perspective you're coming from. You're coming from this stable position where your understanding of the world is stable and static. The world that you're dealing with is fairly stable and static. And the changes that occur are all changes that are within kind of a set where if you were to look at things in an overarching sense, you're not dealing with any changes that really reduce the stability in a greater sense, but changes that simply reduce the kind of apparent stability. Magic requires that you're able to negotiate that stability, and you're able to remove some of the fixation within the sphere of Earth and move things around and then refix them. And in order to be able to do that, you have to understand how creation and destruction work together. That they balance each other in order to keep the world going. They come together in order to create the specifics of a manifestation. That part of creation is destroying everything that is not the thing that's being manifested. Part of it is destroying what was there before the thing manifested. That even the process of stepping through a river destroys what the river was before you stepped within the river and creates something new. But that by committing an act of destruction, you are committing an act of creation. And by committing an act of creation, you are committing an act of destruction. If you paint a portrait, people think of that as creative because you're creating art. But you're destroying the blank canvas. And one can't happen without the other happening. The act of doing one is the act of doing the other. So the magician has to recognize this concept that parent dualities work in tandem, because the two poles are often the same thing. And particularly within this given duality, that the entire basis of his ability to engage in the work is based on engaging this duality. And initially, you kind of conceptualize it as, well, you have on the one hand creation and on the one hand destruction, and you balance the two and apply the two together. And eventually, you come to realize that there's no one hand and the other hand, that they're the same thing. that it's, while the magician's forces are twain, there's still just one magician. And that magician is the amalgamation of creation and destruction. Now, this concept of creation and destruction, in an ultimate symbolic sense, is kind of expressed within the opening passages of Genesis, in which it's describing God creating the world from darkness and from nothing. And it starts out with him separating darkness and light. Now, he doesn't say where the light came from. The light comes from God speaking. And then he separates the two, and then he separates the earth from the water, and all these things that it's just assumed, well, they're there, they're kind of together, and then he makes them distinct. And this process of making them distinct is destroying the previous order in which they're indistinct. And that process of destroying the previous order is creating a new order. But he does this initially by creating dichotomies. And for the dichotomies in which one thing defines the other thing and becomes the border and boundary of the thing that's being created. And he does this through speech. He basically takes something that's universal, and he divides that universal thing out by giving it boundaries through words. In the Sefer Yetzirah, it says that God created the universe through the three borders, and the three borders are, or two of the three borders are letters and numbers. So it's basically this idea of speech and vibration that is creating everything in the universe. And in alchemy, the voice of God upon the waters, which is a term used to describe the creation, is also a term that's used to describe sulfur. Because sulfur is the thing which galvanizes the universal into individual creation. Now, within magic, we can see this process repeatedly in very specific and very general senses. If we look at things like sigil magic, one of the easiest approaches to sigil magic or to incantation is the idea that your speech or your seal is taking the general energy that is making up manifestation or making up the thing that you're trying to affect, and it's redefining the way in which that thing is manifesting. It's essentially carving out a new pathway or new circuit within the overall course of the energy or the overall pattern of the energy, and defining its movement in a way which manifests things in the way that you want. So your sigil or your incantation is essentially the sulfur. It's the voice of God upon the waters, commanding the waters to separate out from the earth and to behave in a given fashion that's watery, and the earth to behave in a fashion that's earthy. It's commanding the darkness to allow light to go forth from the darkness. And this is the same principle that's in place in a lot of talismanic magic. That you stamp the talisman with a seal, and that converts the material of the talisman to the material that's represented by the seal. You're redefining the energy of the talisman into the energy and the vibration of the seal through your consecration and through the application of the seal. Now, in a deeper sense, in more classical ceremonial magic, the talisman is consecrated not simply through the seal, but through contact with the angel or demon that the seal represents. And so their contact is one where, again, in the same Aquinian fashion that we discussed in class one, they are changing the essence of the thing, the actual quintessential nature of the thing. So that the physical body that you see is still the clay or metal or wooden talisman, but the essential nature of the talisman is now no longer the perfect form of clay or wood or metal, but is the actual angel or demon. So it becomes an extension of their makeup or their being. Its material now vibrates in the same nature that that spiritual being vibrates in, much in the same way that tribal and early systems of magic use the doctrine of contagion. You come into contact with a thing, and your repeated contact with the thing affects its essence or affects its vibration so that it matches up to you, and now there's an indelible link between the two. In the case of converting a talisman, it's not so much that they begin to match up and so there's an indelible link, but they are one. The sulfur, which is the angel or the demon, overpowers the sulfur that's already there, impacting the mercury of the talisman, and changes the mercury of the talisman so that it is manifesting the form of the demon or of the angel. So the talisman, applying the talisman at that point, is the same as applying the demon or the angel. And so the various symbols that go with the seal of the spirit on the talisman direct the way in which the spirit's force is applied when the talisman is applied. So if you have the seal of Mars, and then you have a psalm around it or some other versicle, or you have a series of alchemical or planetary or elemental symbols or other sigils wrapping around where the seal is, then those are in place to define the way in which the angelic force of Camiel, for instance, is manifesting through the talisman. Now, this idea can be taken back to the overall idea of manipulating reality through magic. A lot of times people try to approach magic as the creation of a thought form. You begin doing your ritual, and you begin doing your incantations and your invocations, and it's all about building up this idea in your head of what it is that you're trying to create until you have this really clear picture, this really clear emotive element to it, and the forces that you're dealing with are really related to this thing that you're doing. So, say you, what's something that you would want to accomplish in the next 6 months? That's what I was going to guess, actually. Okay, so you're doing your working for your teaching job. And so you do invocations of mythological teachers. So say you invoke Taliesin. And you decide that that has to do with the intellect. So it's airy. So you take, we'll work in a Kabbalistic context. So you take purple for Yesod, or you take yellow for Tiferet. And so you drape your temple in those colors, and you have candles in those colors, and teaching is communicative, so you want to add a little mercury in there, so you burn storax as your incense. So you have these kind of, through your correspondences, you're building up energy related to this particular intellectual goal, and through your invocation, you're specifying that the intellectual goal is related to teaching. And so the overall energy and action and movement within your temple is dealing with that. So you have kind of your exoluthic level there. Then you have your incantation describing the job you want. And so you're creating this intellectual level about what it is that you're trying to get. And so you have this intellectual image and this picture of yourself in your teaching job. And the combination of this energy that you've built up and this intellectual description through your incantation and the picture that you've created in your head all work together to create this emotional state in which you're kind of feeling what it would be to be in this teacher role. And you're expressing all of that out into this thought form where, Kabbalistically speaking, you have the world of Atzilut, or fire, action, and concepts. You have the world of Briah, so emotions and associations, and you have the world of Yetzirah, so the foundational intellectual definition of what it is that these things are manifesting. So the only thing that's left is the physical manifestation. And so the result is that your thought form then goes out into the world and grows up into the physical manifestation that you want to have. And that's one way to work magic. The other way would be to recognize, okay, this is my immediate universe, my immediate sphere of experience. And this is the energy in my universe related to what my job status is. And over here is the immediate universe of this local school. And this is the portion of the energy related to that local school that's related to who's teaching there. And so instead of building up a thought form, you say, okay, I'm going to change the state of my energy to one which reflects me teaching. And I'm going to change the state of the energy that reflects the teachers in the school to one which reflects me as being a teacher in that school. And so your work essentially becomes the sulfur acting on the mercury of the situations that you're trying to impact, so that you are directly manipulating that energy by redefining the form. Your incantation or your sigil isn't about building up another energy and putting that energy into place. It's about changing the energy that's already there. Now, in a sense, building up your thought form and putting your thought form into place could kind of be viewed as alchemical. You're taking the field that you're trying to affect, and you're taking a defined manifestation and putting into the field. But you're kind of trying to artificially create the whole thing with a thought form and just force it into place and sit it there. It's like you've got a great big seed, and you're just kind of putting the seed on the ground and hoping it eventually leaches its way in and grows up. Whereas when you're working in a more direct manner, a more chemical manner, which is much more difficult than the thought form manner, you are actually trying to reach in and say, I'm connecting my being with the being of what I'm trying to change, and I am, through that connection, redefining the state of the thing by defining it within myself the way that I'm trying to manifest it, and expressing that definition into the actual state of things. So it's a little more elegant, but it's a little bit more difficult because you have to develop the faculties to be able to recognize the states of things, and also the authority to be able to, by fiat, say that those states of things are changing. And that's part of what the process of initiation does for you, is it teaches you those alchemical steps in order to be able to engage in that understanding, to connect to the thing, and to institute the change. And it produces the authority and the perspective in order to have the ability and the right to do that. And that pretty much covers kind of how you would use alchemy in a magical sense. But I do have another note here about the idea of taking alchemical processes magically, as opposed to simply taking alchemical ideas magically, where you could begin working magic to create a process in a thing that simulates a given alchemical process in order to break it down to the point in which it's able to change in the way in which you need it to change. So you could kind of magically conceptualize the nature of putrefaction, and then conjure putrefaction as a force onto whatever it is you're trying to change, so that it begins to kind of stagnate and break down and rot away, so that all the things that are not essential to the thing begin to break off, and you can start to deal with the essential nature of the thing, and then use other magical processes and other magical applications of alchemical processes to begin changing and directing and initiating the thing in the manner in which it needs to be processed in order to result in what's necessary. And that can kind of get back into the idea of alchemy and magic as means of kind of instigating and performing the great work, because you are kind of initiating the things around you just as you would initiate the material in front of you in an alchemy laboratory. Or it could also be used in the charcoal burner fashion of, I need some gold, so let me change lead into gold. And you recognize that by breaking down some of these falsehoods around a thing, that its truth is going to be more amenable to what it is that you're trying to accomplish. So it can be kind of a selfless great work act or a selfish great work act. It may result in the same thing either way. Who knows? So the remaining topics that I had were the Eucharist, sexual magic and mysticism, alchemy and life, and the Philosopher's Stone. And those are all kind of big topics. So, I would say offhand, dropping alchemy and life is the easiest one to drop. The Philosopher's Stone is largely just that I have kind of a hard-on slash obsession for the search for the stone, and wanted to talk about my theories regarding that, but it's really a little bit outside of what the class is really about.
But you can rant at us about it pretty much any time.
I can, and I probably have in the past.
That's okay.
Yes, I'm sure, Stephanie, you've heard about my views on collecting semen and blood and urine and creating the stone that way. Yes, so, Eucharistics is probably the most appropriate thing.
I find it amusing because you're somewhat squeamish.
Yeah. But, I mean, this stuff's all processed then. It's not semen and blood and urine anymore. So, the Eucharist is something that we deal with all the time as Thelemites. Not just in the Gnostic Mass, but if you've attended many group rituals around an OTO body, usually they're going to be Eucharistic because it's the type of magic that people connected to the OTO see in a group sense most often. And so, as they develop their ideas of what group magic is, it's developed around the idea of, well, there's a Eucharist, and you're doing Eucharistic magic. Now, you can easily do group ritual without any of that, but it's a fairly convenient manner of doing it.
It's fine.
It is. And you can do individual ritual with Eucharists, and it can be pretty effective. Now, you can kind of look at the creation of the Eucharist as being talismanic magic, or you can look at it just being alchemical. But from what we already talked about with talismanic magic is really kind of alchemical in its underlying nature anyway. I would say if you look at the Roman Catholic Church versus the Gnostic Catholic Church, some people don't think that there's much of any difference between the process of consecrating the Eucharist between the two, but the execution and the mechanics are, at least in my mind, very different. In the Roman Catholic Church, you have this very Solomonic process going on, where the saints and the martyrs and Christ himself are all invoked, and the priest, as the Alter Christus, or the other Christ, is aligning himself with all of these forces. Solomonic magic aligns the magician with God through the image of the divine hero. Who in most of the books is Solomon, one of the earliest ones it's Moses, and in the Catholic Mass it's Christ, the martyrs, and the saints. So, in doing this, the priest is trying to say that he is the functioning presence of these spiritual entities and realities, and that through his prayer over the Eucharist, he is able to communicate that reality into the Eucharist. So he is alchemically transmuting the Eucharist into the collective nature of the Christian mysteries as they're expressed in the iconography of the life of Christ. So the actual idea within the Catholic priesthood is that the Eucharist is not a single sacrament or a single mystery, but it is a sacramentalization of the entirety of the Christian mysteries. That the birth, life, death, and resurrection of Christ are all communicated through the Eucharist. So the Eucharist itself initiates you into the entirety of the mysteries through making you a manifestation of the Alter Christus in the way in which the priest is functioning as the Alter Christus. But you do not become the sacrifice, which the priest does. You are simply mirroring Christ instead of becoming Christ. It's a little weird because you're doing so by eating bread that has become Christ through the alchemical process of the priest becoming the presence of Christ in the martyrs and the saints. In the Gnostic Catholic Church, we have a little bit less shame about our Eucharist, and so we're okay with recognizing that through eating the Eucharist, you are becoming divine. You pronounce that at the end of the Mass when you take it. Our process is a little different, though. The deacon invokes the saints, but he's not saying he is the saints. He's not invoking them in the sense of saying that all of these things are coming into the deacon so he can touch the Eucharist and make it those things. It could be argued that he's calling upon the saints so that they manifest through the priest, and the priest finishes that when he strikes his breast and calls upon the saints. But that is simply the priest aligning himself to a certain type of force at that point, which is kind of what the Catholic priests are doing. But the force there is not, well, okay, I won't say that it's not the force that's within the Eucharist, because the Lord of life and joy, that art the might of man, that art the essence of every true God that is upon the surface of the earth, is kind of what's being ingested in the Eucharist, or is one thing that you could take as being what's ingested through the Eucharist.
And it's tasty.
Yes. But the overall nature of the Mass is that the entirety of the ritual is outlining these cosmic processes of interaction in a kind of alchemical and Kabbalistic way, in which you have symbolism from both structures working together, or symbolism from the Kabbalah and through from Thelemic mythology working together in an alchemical way in which you're balancing the two polar forces into a single force that allows for the access of the balanced spiritual force, or the gold of the philosophers. You have the what could be conceptualized as Hesed and Gevurah, mercy and severity, Jupiter and Mars, the expansiveness of the masculine, the constrictiveness of the feminine, masculine water and feminine fire taken together. So you essentially have the triangles of the holy hexagram, and they come together to balance into Tiferet and gain give entry to the sun, just as the triangles of the hexagram come together and give entry into Tiferet. And so it's not the priest becoming the mystery and touching the host so that the host becomes the mystery, but the host being initiated through the process of the mystery and through the same alchemy that the initiate undergoes, so that the entire process of the explication of the mystery is engaged within the host, and the congregants consume the host and consume the mysteries within themselves. So there's an overlap in the result with the overlap of Christianity, or with the result in Christianity, but there's not the distancing that occurs. And it's a little bit more of a hands-on mechanic in the Gnostic Eucharist. And the Eucharist that we create in the Gnostic Catholic Church is much more aligned to the type of Eucharist that you create in most forms of Eucharistic magic, in which case you are essentially creating a process that initiates the host into the force or the nature that you're trying to communicate through the Eucharist. So you would build up your ritual or your signs or your incantation around the idea of what's being expressed, and what's being communicated to those who are going to be experiencing the Eucharist. And you engage these processes around the actual host to initiate the host and imbue it with the force that echoes both the result and the process, so that the communication of the Eucharist is communicating that result and process and activating them within the congregation, performing an essential initiation for them. And this is the same idea that's in place when you're using alchemical tinctures related to the planets or the elements or other forces and ingesting them for initiatic purposes. You're essentially creating alchemical Eucharists with all of these different tinctures that it's recommended that you make and have on hand as an alchemist. I would say, though, definitely explore the RC method because there are interesting things about how that's done when it's done correctly. And you can see some of the overlaps between alchemical magic and Solomonic magic that way, and how the alchemy still kind of underlies the other method.
They just don't want to admit it, that's all.
Yes. Which the funny thing is, they'd probably be more comfortable saying, yes, I'm an alchemist, then yes, I'm doing ceremonial evocation magic. So, any questions?
I'll have questions after I process it for a couple of days.
Okay.
And then I'll bother you.
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah, maybe I'll do a whole other class at some point on the Philosopher's Stone. And then I could go through more of the materials proving that the stone is not the metal stone.
Okay then.
Yes. Which, even in Basil Valentin's 12 Keys, he's making arguments for, well, he's not making arguments for the metal stone, he's explaining the process of creating the metal stone, but he talks about the Philosopher's Stone while he's talking about them, so it appears as if they're the same stone, but his descriptions of what's necessary for the Philosopher's Stone remove the metal stone from being a possibility. And some of the things that he talks about in there in terms of why he would seek after the stone and why man seeks after the stone and why man's in the position in which man is in reflects the nature of what the actual stone is. So it's an interesting way of veiling the material. He's not like Paracelsus, who just says straight up, it's not that. But anyway, so thank you for coming to the alchemy classes. And I hope that they were worth your time. And
I'm worth the drive.
Yes. And maybe we'll do other alchemy things in the future.
We should. We should blow shit up.
Yes. Just not, not ourselves.
Well, no.
Not like Saint Jack.
Well, but his destruction is creation.
That's irrelevant.
And I mean,
we would create something else that would not be us, and that would piss us off.
Piles of singed goo.
I mean,
I do not wish to be a pile of singed crew at this point in time.
If you strike me down, I will become more powerful than you can imagine. But
thank you very much, everyone.
Yes. But it only works if someone else strikes me down, so I can't blow myself up. L. Ron Hubbard has to come do it.
Right, exactly. I don't feel like being L. Ron Hubbard right now.
Thank you.
I think I'm cuter.
Well, I would agree with that. So, but yeah, we can save the blowing.
Blowing other things up, just
yes.
Not myself. It is true that the person who did pyrotechnics at our live role-playing game, it got to the point where he would do things in such a risky way that after a while we'd start making him do finger checks. Like, okay, how many fingers do you have left? All five.
Yep,
okay,
that
other
does,
hand?
That actually sounds kind of like the Suicide Squad.
Yeah. We're kind of assholes, really.
We can blow up the Great Sorcery.
You should see Gordon with gasoline.
Oh, God.
He can calculate the flow of the gasoline fire to the point that it was this close to somebody's tent, but it didn't burn it up. He's just like, see, I know what I'm doing. And I'm like, I know, honey, the statute of limitation is up on some of what I know.